Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Ready to experience the Gnostic Sophia in a deeper reality never felt before? Find the truth about the divine feminine in Gnostic tradition, ancient and modern, and how to reverse Sophia's rebellion that created this coded reality ruled by Archons. Is Sophia a Gnostic goddess, fallen angel, the Holy Spirit, mother of demons, alien scientist, Gaia, or Mary Magdalene? Find out August 9th and 10th for 2 days of immersive and mystic experience at Astrognosis, Sophia in Simulated Realities. Expert speakers will address the manifestations of Sophia and the nature of reality itself. Astrognosis 3 includes interactive workshops, meditations, vendors, and social events at the Theosophical Society, Wheaton, Illinois. Don't miss this unique opportunity to learn, connect, and grow with fellow seekers. Come listen and interact with Maja Daou, Mitch Horowitz, Chris Knowles, Richard Smoley, Ola Wolny, James True, Dan Morris, Diana Kelly, Steven Snyder, and more from Aeon Byte. Sponsorship opportunities available. Theosophical Society, Wheaton, Illinois, August 9th and 10th. Tickets at thegodabovegod.com or Eventbrite. See you there. Happy heresies and welcome to the Desert of the Real. My name is Miguel Connor and I am your Pompidus of Gnosis. And yes, as you heard in the intro, we are getting closer to Astrognosis 3 a week from this Friday, and it's very exciting. Tickets are on sale still. Online tickets are on sale where you can interact on YouTube. You will get a replay regardless if you go there physic in the flesh, as Pink Floyd sang, or if you watch it online and you can ask questions if you get online tickets. So lots going on. We've sold more tickets than even last year. More guests. We have meditation, Gnostic exercises. We will have the social, which will include some interactive chanting. So it's going to be great, and I hope to see you there. As always, but yes, welcome everybody. I already see people in the chat going in, and I am very excited about this show because this is a topic that, really I have engaged with a lot in the last year or two and has definitely made my consciousness more expanded. So with us, it is an honor and a pleasure to be joined by Dara Mason to discuss his new book, Song of the Dark Man, Father of Witches, Lord of the Crossroads. Dara, thank you very much for coming on the show.
A real pleasure to be here, Miguel. Thank you for the invite.
Pleasure is all ours. And with us too, we've got Graham Pong. Vance is tied up in his Clark Kent manifestation at his day job. So Graham will be with us today. Graham, how are you doing?
Oh, very good. Always happy to pinch in for Vance.
Awesome. Well, it will be a good one. Not much else on the housekeeping. Maybe later. As always, if you do have any questions for Dara or complaints against me, please super chat them so we can separate them and get to them. Yes, and no matter how, what foul things you say to me, I'm always glad to address them. Me and my shadow are just fine these days, and I don't project. I project a fraction of what I used to. I don't think things personally. But, well, let's start with you, Dara. I love this book was great. I love reading it. And as you yourself say, it's hard to know where to start, right? Because as you say in your book, there is an Irish saying. And when a tourist goes to a local man, he'll go, well, how do I get to X town? And he will be told, well, I wouldn't start from here. So this is what we're dealing with the dark men, right?
Yeah. It's a very, very complex, complex phenomenon and archetype in almost every conceivable way, really.
Well, why don't we start with you? You yourself write in your book that a few years ago, I think it was 2021, you had a vision of the dark man. Tell the audience about that. I don't know if that's the beginning, but it's definitely a good start.
It all started with my own kind of experiments, my own podcast, where I was looking just broadly was drawn to this idea, and where I look at like folklore broadly, the world of the spirits and magic as broad themes. What I kept finding when I was exploring Irish folklore, and I came back to Irish folklore after looking at the djinn as a broad topic, which came from some of my I used to be a travel photographer, so some shoots I did in India in related to the djinn. That kind of just started as an interesting subject matter, but kind of all went a bit weird when I was out there. But I'm sure we'll get to that. But in 2021, I started kind of properly investing into really kind of magical practice. For years, I've been experimenting with the standard stuff, right? Chaos magic and, you know, saw the Grant Morrison Discord stuff and like when YouTube first arrived, you know, saw that then and kind of like everybody else who got the book, you know, was experimenting with sigil magic and all that kind of stuff.
I was there, yes.
Yeah. I got involved with Thelema and through some of the kind of the initial practice work of like building the energy body and what have you, building the body of light. I just started to do kind of like the daily resh exercises, middle pillar, that kind of stuff. And when I was doing the middle pillar, things started happening. I had a poster of the Tree of Life on the wall that like kept falling off during the meditation, right? You know. And you know, you get superstitious enough when you're in this where you're like, you know, it could just be the blue tack, but it was enough for me to kind of just start to notice all these things. And then the last time I did it, because I never did it again after what happened, last time I did the middle pillar, I had this intense visionary experience where a black angel appeared to me, jet black, against them, a wall of fire, showed me some symbols related to Lucifer and what have you. And that, you know, speaking frankly, scared the bejesus out of me. You know, I was like bitten off more than chew here, and I stopped practicing. I didn't really speak about it for months. A witch friend who was a confidant and you know, has become a very good friend, basically put me in touch with a person who was training tarot with her, but actually came to her through listening to my show. And we started working together. This lady was called, it's called Michelle Devezes. And she's extremely psychic. And through working with her quite intensely over a period of 18 months, started to unpack what was going on through various deep envision quests and what have you, and a lot of stuff started to come through and fall into place and marry up with all the folkloric exploration that I've been doing, because I kept finding this theme come up again and again of this in Irish, the term, or in Gaelic, the term on fire dove, the dark man or the black man, and on fire durka, the dark man, which was two names for the same figure. So that kept coming up in folklore while this happened. And then at the same time, I was interviewing multiple magic practitioners from different angles and different schools. The theme of people who act as witchcraft, sort of talking about this dark man or this man in black that would appear in vision, appear in dream, or manifest and essentially switch them on, you know, zap them, for want of a better word. And that kind of was the catalyst, you know, for a lot of them really taking on their practice. So I just noticed that this theme an awful lot, and kind of I know it sounds a bit cheesy, but I think it noticed me noticing it.
Yeah, that's I was just thinking that too, Dara. It was John Keel and his Mothman explaining one guy, was it in the movie Richard Gere? Yeah. Why me? Is like, you notice them, they notice you. But these, I don't want to say beings, because I almost feel like Paul Levy, if you try to describe them, they'll move away or they will shift, because they are, lack of better word, tricksters. They have a different morality, but they like the attention and they will turn your life upside down for no reason at all. So I think that's that fascinating thing. It also reminds me too, sorry, it almost reminds me, for some reason Dr. Evil kept coming up, because remember in the movies with Scott, he wants to raise Scott to be a successor, but he's always trying to kill him. That's kind of the dark man, right? You just it's a different morality that you just might as well not put your human mind around.
Totally. You know, and we have a real tendency to do that, you know. Yeah. And it's one of the things why there's so many names, you know, because we're always trying to categorize this and you can't, you know. I quote Robin Artisan, the witch Robin Artisan, quite a bit in the book around this. I think he's excellent on this topic from a witchcraft perspective, and he basically says it's impossible to pin down what he calls the master. You know, he will not be pinned down. There's no true form. There's no true name. And the minute you think you have it pinned down is kind of when you're screwed. You know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you don't even know what your role is, what his role, but there is a way. Hopefully we can talk about, you can lean into this being and just go with it. And I think it's the ultimate humility for us humans to simply,
you know, that you picked the most appropriate word, I think. I was chatting with a few friends, some of the same people I mentioned earlier, last week when I went for a bite of food. We were just kind of reflecting on the past couple of years, and humility is one of those words that came up. Mm-hmm. You know, it is, you're going to face your shadow, and you're going to come out of it humble.
Yes. You know? Yes. Yeah. Very much. Or is also, there's the story that John Michael Greer writes so well in his book, The King in Orange, of the Changer. And he puts all the legends of the natives here in the United States, and sometimes it's the moon, sometimes it's a coyote, whatever, but this being comes from nowhere and simply goes to a man and says things are going to change. And of course us humans are like, oh, you know, we like safety, we like the way things are. Yeah. And tries to attack this being, and this being says, oh yeah, and turns him into an even more primitive form of existence, into an animal or an object. And of course the lesson is, right, change is always coming, is whether you're going to go with the flow or you're going to end up left behind.
Yeah, very much so. You know, and that is exactly reflected in the folklore. Mm-hmm. You know, you see it again and again when the archetype, it plays out in these fairy stories in Ireland. You have a dark rider, you have the king of the fairies, you know, and it's always this kind of potent figure. One of the things that I really picked up on exploring the folklore and looking at it from this perspective was there were some distinct themes that kind of that came up. So firstly, there was the dark title, the black title, an appellation that comes up again and again, that description. Secondly, there was this, the interrupted journey, right? So this dark rider and the interrupted journey. You find the same thing in the accounts of some of the witches. I mean, Isabel Gowdy, her confession, she talks about walking along the road near the, I think it's near the church at Aldehern, if I recall correctly, and her journey's interrupted by this dark figure on the road, the devil on the road. So that comes up again and again. And then there's obviously the trickster element. And there's a sexual interest in human beings. And then there's shape-shifting. You know, these come up again and again.
Yeah, those a lot of those overlap with the trickster. Why do you think is again, the sexuality? Again, you have an interview with Megan Rose, who's been on the show, her great book, Spirit Marriage. And of course, Maja Daou has a great book on familiars. And yeah, sex is big time. All I can think of is that sex in our world is the ultimate form of information. And that's the sort of information that these beings can pass, because they got better things to learn than learn English or whatever the hell, you know. They have symbols and myths and sex. So what do you, is that it, or what do you think there?
I think that that's certainly a component of it. You know, what I hypothesize it is potentially also going on is it also is a ritual act in the sense that it is a homage to the creative force within, you know, that regenerative force. So the dark man seems to be intrinsically linked to, in my opinion, to forces of nature. And we see this in some of the ways that he manifests, where he's what I call a composite being, very similar to, well, I mean, the other term is therianthrop. Mm-hmm. This goes back to the earliest cave art, where we see depictions of beings in this state that are part human, multiple part animal. What comes up again and again in the folklore is shape-shifting. You also get the part animal description. And that again is replicated in people's experiences in the accounts of witches who've come up have brushed up against or been tapped on the shoulder by him.
Indeed. And of course, in Western culture, we often talk about this being as the devil, but I think Gordon White wrote, I forget in what book, he wrote very well that the devil has been kind of changed. There's three levels to the devil. There's, of course, the evil, pissed off, resentful angel has nothing better to do than, you know, try to destroy humanity. Like, doesn't he have other things to do? Then there's, of course, the Lucifer, the light bringer, the Prometheus, you know, the god of the, you know, the Renaissance and the magician. But then you've got the third, which is sort of this folk Satan who does stuff like steal your sheep and, you know, create, burn your butt. He's just out there in the woods causing havoc. So I think the dark man is more of this sort of folk devil, isn't he?
I think he's got bits of all of them. You know, I mean, I would say kind of like the first kind of like the Abrahamic kind of opposer devil, or, you know, Satan. Like, I understand why people associate it. Over my time researching this, I don't associate him with that. I certainly associate him with the second and the third. But I see him manifest in different ways. The ones I'm probably most familiar with are like a Saturnian version and then a kind of Mercurial version. You know, when the Mercurial one has all the trickster elements that you would expect, that energy. The Saturnian one is more severe. But I personally, I would associate the Dark Man as being an an emanation in the hierarchy of Lucifer, some description.
For sure, for sure. And yeah, I want to share a story with you, and then maybe because the reading your stories, you talk about Irish folk tales and all that, and Tuatha De Nannan. I had a remembrance, Dara, and it parallels all these stories. And these stories are probably universal, but I was born in Portugal. I was there as a kid. And one time, my mom and my aunt, who's a nun, we went to Nazaré, which is north of north of Lisbon. For those of you who might not know, that's where they have the giant waves, and the German guy broke the record. Oh. You can find it all on YouTube. And Nazaré, beautiful place, but yes, you don't go in the sea. And we were visiting, and we went to this rock, and there's this big rock by the cliffs, and there's a like an indentation, like a hoof mark. And I asked my mom and my aunt, what is this? And this is part of a legend there. There was a noble, a good man, and he was out. And it gets very misty, and it was very misty. So who comes? The devil. What does the devil do? He turns into a deer, and he goes over the cliff so that the man will go over the cliff and fall to his death. So, of course, the man is suddenly, the noble goes, oh, no, I am going over the cliff. And he immediately calls upon the Virgin Mary and prays, and suddenly this energy comes and fuses the horse's hoof into the stone so he doesn't fall off the cliff. And Satan, damn you, Satan. But now I realize this man had to have his faith tested, and the devil or this dark man was doing what it does. And again, this appears in Irish folktale too, the deer or the trap, right?
The deer thing is huge, you know, and really it kind of hangs this kind of thesis together from my perspective, you know, because it makes a direct thematic link between this ancient Irish mythology and what the witches are describing in the Scottish witch trials, you know, and that kind of that blew me away. And it's quite specific in how it comes up. In the Fianna cycle, which is kind of there's three major mythological cycles that are most well known, right? So you have kind of the Toinbó Cúile, which is the story of Cú Chulainn and the cattle raid of Cooley, right? And Cú Chulainn is this kind of demigod who is like this, he's the son of Lú, and basically single-handedly defends Ulster against the forces of the province of Connacht, right? And it's an interesting story, because it all comes down to essentially the king and queen of Connacht are having this basically a pissing contest of who has the most cool stuff. Right. And the king of Connacht basically says, well, I've got this brown bull that's amazing. And Queen Maeve gets pissed off because she doesn't have an equivalent. So offers to buy the white bull of Ulster, and basically sends some of her people up there to buy the bull. It all goes pear-shaped and we have war. But Cú Chulainn basically is this kind of Irish Hercules who defeats armies by himself, kind of thing. That's a wonderful, wonderful story for those who are interested. The others we would say are kind of like the Tuatha De Danann legends, you know, for kind of would be part of kind of the Book of Invasions corpus, and that kind of again is part of that kind of struggle for the tribes who eventually inhabit and rule Ireland over kind of millennia. I talk about the two to some degree, but that the two are kind of part of that kind of, it's very similar to like the Tuatha versus the Fomorians is very similar to the Olympians versus the Titans, and this similar juxtaposition in Norse mythology, it's the same kind of thing. But the Fenian cycle, which is about the Fianna, right, who are these Irish kind of warrior poets, these noble heroes. They're led by a guy called Finn McCool. And to help orientate people, they would be kind of similar to your Knights of the Round Table, right? Mm. You know? That's kind of what they would represent. Now, interestingly, like Fianna, that word that they're named after, the root of that is Fia, which means deer. Okay, so it's integrally ensconced in their mythology. The principal thing that happens that kind of that I noted is there's three kind of major occasions where a woman is transformed into a deer by quote unquote an evil force or a dark force. And that starts with a poem. Well, one of the pieces that we have this happen is a poem called Fafland, which is from a corpus of known as the Metrical Dinshakas. Mm-hmm. And that is a collection of these kind of like, they're kind of mytho legends to explain the place names of Ireland. It was this kind of monastic text to why this place is called these names. And it was kind of like down to this kind of whatever fantastical thing that happened. But you have it happen with, you also have it with a Lord of the Dead who is called Don Dove. So Don means brown, Dove means black. Don in kind of older Irish could also mean kind of like dark as well. So, right. So we know that kind of the Lord of the Dead is called kind of a kind of dark one. Right. Now he does the same thing with some of the Fianna, where he sends a fairy woman called Lady Mal in the form of the deer to lure some of the Fianna to his kind of otherworld kingdom. Right. They're hunting the deer and find themselves in the underworld. Now, where it gets really interesting is we have the story of Hion Macu, right, and how he meets the mother of his child, Usheen.
Mm.
Right? So Fionn, who is the kind of, again, the Arthurian type figure. Now, it's important to note that Fionn means fair-haired, all right, or like kind of white, essentially, right? So automatically we have, okay, his kind of opposing figure is going to be, which is called in the folklore, some of the dark men of the dark man of the Sidhe, which is the dark man of the fairies, or the black magician of the men of God, right? Men of God refers to the Danann, right? So we've got white versus black. We have the duality play happening. Right. He's out hunting deer. They're always out hunting deer. And he and his dogs find this doe. And she behaves strangely. The dogs won't attack her. So Fionn knows something strange, but brings the doe back to his fortress. That night, this beautiful, beautiful woman comes into his room. And she introduces herself as Saiva. And she explains that she basically seeks refuge from this black magician who turned her into a deer. Right. And the black magician wanted to marry her. She refused. She would only marry one person, one man. And Fionn was immediately jealous because he's beholding this beautiful, beautiful fairy woman. And then is delighted to find out that one man's him. And so they immediately fall in love. But unfortunately, their time together is short lived because. Actually, before I get into that, there is one little passage where Saiva describes the dark man and his power, right? Where there's no indication of his, like his hierarchy, but she says, you know, he's in the wind, he's in the rivers and the streams looking, he's in the bushes watching, he is everywhere and I'm afraid, right? So she hints at this kind of omnipotence that this figure has. Anyway, Fionn is called away on some of his warrior duties to defend Ireland against some invading Vikings. And while he's away, Saiva waits for his return. And then she sees him coming up the road towards their fort. And being kind of a dutiful partner, she runs out to meet him. When she gets to meet him, it's not Fionn, transforms into the dark man. Tricked her, shape-shifting, and then he touches on her head with a hazel wand and she's immediately transformed back into a deer, and Fionn never sees her again.
Wow.
Now, 7 years pass, and Fionn is heartbroken and lovesick. Explores Ireland, looking everywhere for Saibhin, but he never finds her. And then he finds this boy, this 7-8-year-old boy with a shock of blonde hair, who describes being in a faraway place behind the mist, from beyond the mist. And there was a deer who was always kind to me, and there was fruit and food always available. And sometimes a man in black would come, and he would berate the deer, but he would bring food and then leave. And then this boy found himself here. And Fionn works out that this is his son. He recognizes the child's features in his own face and his missing beloved. So he takes him in, realizing who he is, and he calls him Oisín, which means little deer. So, and the interesting thing about this is that Oisín is half fairy, right? So we have a non-dualistic metaphor in him, right? Then we get to the 17th century, and particularly the account of Scottish witch Isabel Gowdie, as she describes the devil, or Black John, as she experienced him, as a great rough man or a great meckle man, who sometimes would have boots or shoes on his feet, but still his feet are forked and cloven, and would sometimes be in the form of a deer or a ray. And a ray was this archaic Scottish term for a roe deer. So we have in her confession a remarkable experiential link between this Irish mythology and this witchcraft, you know, and which is astonishing. There's a phrase that is used in Joshua Cutchin's work, where he describes that inversion is representation in these stories. So it's not the woman who is in deer form, but it's the devil. He's part deer form. Or deer form. So I found that astonishing when I kind of worked that through, you know, that this thematic thread is there, right? And this work goes a long way back. I mean, the Fenian stories, the earliest kind of versions of these are found in a manuscript called An Column na Shanarach, which means colloquially of the old men, or colloquially of the ancients. And two of the, it's made up of three books. There's two from 15th century, the Book of Lishmore, and a text called Laud 610, and a third from Killiney in Dublin, dating from the 17th century. But linguistically, they're able to kind of track that back and say that the language indicates a 12th century origin. But we know that the manuscripts reflect a far older linguistic tradition. So it's, I would say these stories and versions of these stories go all the way back into antiquity.
For sure. And we can go back to Artemis, who was the great mother in a lot of parts of the ancient world. And of course, Diana was a patroness of the witches. So the deer, as I've told my audience, you might not know, Dara, but last year I had visions. I was called by Artemis.
Oh, wow.
To worship her. And of course, we go to humility. My ego was like, son of a bitch, the most unforgiving goddess of all, the most vicious of all the goddesses had to be. Yeah. It couldn't have been Aphrodite, or it had to be. But I kept my mouth shut and I worship and sacrifice. I was like, I'm not going to mess with this one. I'm just going to. It was a very good lesson in spiritual humility, Dara. And I'm glad that she was the one.
I share that sentiment. You know, I never get anything chill, you know.
Yeah, it's a nice chill god or something. Yeah. Awesome. Well, I wanted to Dara has plenty of more of these stories in his book, Song of the Dark Man, and folk tales from hooves in the snow to hands that come and pull your wheel. I mean, just so many mind-boggling stuff, and they are wonderful. And his book is coming out. It's out from Inner Traditions, from their subdivision Destiny Books, which is the same subdivision that's going to put out my book on Elvis, the occult Elvis, and very interesting connections we can talk about, because again, I call Elvis in the book the Lord of the Crossroads. You talk about Robert Johnson, and in my book, I put all these connections together, like Elvis and Robert Johnson died on the same day. And you look at their careers and what they were doing, there's a lot of, they were messing with something, this folk spirit, probably an African trickster spirit down in Mississippi and in that area. And they tapped into some powers because, again, both Robert Johnson and Elvis kind of embodied the trickster too. I mean, Robert Johnson didn't know how to play the guitar, and then suddenly he comes back. When you read it, when you look at Elvis's story, you're like, wait a second. You had this teenager who was studying to be an electrician, who drove a truck, who hung out by a record company, and these insane series of events that defy logic. A year later, he's the biggest star in the world. But anyway, but yeah, I wanted to mention a sponsor here, and that is Inner Traditions, because Inner Traditions is sponsoring Astronosis. They're a great company, and yeah, they put out great books. So please, if you can, check out Inner Traditions is a proud sponsor of the Astronosis Conference. Please visit innertraditions.com to browse new and classic occult and esoteric titles. Inner Traditions has been publishing occult and esoteric books since 1975. Based in Rochester, Vermont, Inner Traditions specializes in books, ebooks, audiobooks, card decks, and other products that convey the spiritual, cultural, and mythical traditions of the world. The Inner Tradition imprint focuses on esoteric knowledge, occult wisdom, and perennial philosophies. It is the mission of Inner Traditions to rediscover, preserve, and protect the esoteric and spiritual traditions of the world. Shop thousands of books and cards deck at Inner Traditions. And that is very true. They are, they really do put out, I mean, if they're putting up books about the Dark Men and then books about Elvis, you know they're covering all their bases, right, Dara?
I'm fascinated by your book from the bits you told me about. It sounds really cool.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I'd love to talk to you about it maybe on your podcast. But yeah, I have a whole section of Elvis, the Crossroads. I go into the blues, obviously, is based. There's so many stories about the devil doing exactly what the Dark Man does. Mm-hmm. You know, he will destroy a slave owner, but then he'll make you fall into a bog and die the next day. You know, it's these stories over and over. And the blues men really tapped into it. Mm-hmm. And all their songs and tales is about the devil. Again, obviously, it's based on this fusion, since we have to categorize of Satan plus this animus trickster spirit that they brought from Africa. And then, of course, the blues just keeps growing. Yeah. And it affects, obviously, Robert Johnson, Elvis, so many, even the ones that were, you know, like Jesus, Holy Rollers, love the blues. It was just this amazing fusion of gospel.
And
the blues too. And then you add, of course, ecstatic Christianity, Pentecostalism. You get rock and roll.
It's so interesting. It really is. And kind of in what I was kind of researching, the kind of the demonic aspect of the bit in my book, obviously, as you picked up, music was a real theme there. But even kind of before that, again, we have it in the folklore again. You know, it's like the pipers are associated with the greatest pipers in Ireland are said to have been, you know, told their music, taught their music by the fairies. You know, and even then, like, and there was also kind of like a little bit of skullduggery there. Like, you know, if a piper wanted to be famous, he'd like start rumors about himself that he was like, you know, kind of taken by the fairies. And it's really interesting stuff. And that thing is that kind of inspiration from the other is fairly universal. Certainly the jinn are associated with the inspiration of poetry, you know, and even like in, where is it now? I interviewed a, I can't remember her name, but she's a doctor from a folkloric doctor from a PhD rather from the Balkans, who had done an awful lot of research into the Vash people who still had kind of a lot of like a kind of a fairy faith. Mm-hmm. And she was saying there was modern stories of like, again, a piper who kind of was taken by the fairies and kind of bedded by the queen of the fairies. And then like the local girls were kind of like enthralled by him because he had this reputation of this masterful musician, but also had been touched by the fairies romantically. There was a huge interest in him. But yeah, looking at that, like, you know, I looked at the kind of the Robert Johnson stuff, as you've already mentioned, but I found this amazing interview with Bob Dylan, which just blew my mind. Like, I couldn't get over it. And I think it was in it's in the early 2000s. I think it's that, like, it's an American show, 60 Minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's asked, like, after all this years of success, why are you still touring, you know? And his response was, it all goes back to a destiny thing. I made a bargain with a long time ago, and I'm holding up my end. And then when he's pressed as to who this is, and he said, it's the commander, the chief commander of this earth.
Yeah.
The world we can't see. You know, and it's one of those ones where you're like, holy shit,
some people think, well, it was a very Gnostic. You're talking about the demiurge or the cosmo creator?
Yeah. Just who exactly do you mean there? You know, so it was fascinating to see that. You know, that really kind of blew my mind.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Oh, yeah, indeed. And it is the same because your book, you talk about, again, the Pied Piper, the German tale where he gets double crossed after getting rid of the mice. So he takes the children probably to the fairy world. So,
yeah,
again, the music, the dark man. And it's strange, too, because in my book, there is a passage I do compare Elvis to the Pied Piper because once out of World War II, America just was suddenly this mighty empire with more money than it knew what to do, an army. And it was like, what do we do? And I said, Elvis kind of pied people into a more multicultural, multi-spiritual, open-minded thing. And of course, Elvis had a shadow side, just like America, materialistic, violent, all that. But so I relate him to the Pied Piper. And of course, the Silent Generation, there were others, Noam Chomsky, Martin Luther King Jr., these figures that sort of led America out into whatever its role was. So there is those connections.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And the Pied Piper was described as being tremendously handsome as well. You know?
Yeah.
One thing that comes up in these stories again and again, and it ties into, like, it kind of, it walks a line between the mercurial and the Saturnian, but there's always a test of character. There's a test of metal, you know, and there's a question of, kind of, well, what are your values? What do you stand for? You know, that some of the situations that the dark man will, present to you. And this is where the terror comes from. This is where the horror is, right? You know, because you're going to face your fears. You know, and that has bad press for a reason.
Yeah, nobody wants to face their shadow, or we all think we're good enough, and suddenly you're put in an almost impossible situation. You're over a cliff, and you're like, what do I do? And the trickster's like, it's your choice. I just put you there.
Yeah, totally. And you know, and you, like, you're asked all these questions of like, well, what, you know, again, what do you believe? What's important to you? And what do you react to? Like, so, like I found the whole process astonishing, difficult, challenging, all of those things often at once. There's bits that I don't want to go through again, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But that's what it is. It that's part of it, you know. It is a call to a different life, you know. Maybe it's a call to witchcraft, maybe it's a call to something else. But it's certainly going to change how you see the world.
It is true. It is very true. Grandma, what do you think? What comment or question for Dara?
I was going to say there was one that I was kind of, it may be a bit of a tangent, but his insight into one of the parts of the Finian cycle that sort of stuck out like a sore thumb to me, so to speak, is the Salmon of Knowledge. That's just any insights into that one and how that fits into the whole Irish cycle? Hey.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot with that. And like for me, it kind of comes into, it ties heavily with our relationship with nature. So to start with that, there's a story in the Book of Invasions. So Leabhar Gal Éireann, which literally translates as the Book of the Taking of Ireland, right? And it goes through kind of like a mytho history of the different tribes that came to Ireland, that invaded, that perished, and what have you. And the Tuan MacCardle is this figure that came to Ireland pre-flood. So it's this Andaluvian figure. And he retains the memories of his centuries of kind of dream lives in Ireland. So his people, I think, are they're wiped out by the plague or flood. I can't remember specifically. But he is reincarnated as he's reincarnated as a stag, as a boar, as a hawk, and then finally a salmon. And he's eaten, he's captured and eaten by the Queen of Ulster. And as he's eaten, he impregnates her. And then he's born again as Tuan the Human. But the importance of that story and the kind of the symbol of the salmon is that essentially it talks about its representation of the restoration of being in right relation with a living cosmos. You know, it's removing our separation from the animal world, from the natural world, through kind of and defeating duality therein, right? You know, it's showing that we're actually all part of nature. His experiences, the experiences are Ireland in multiple forms, and he does so in kind of in the totem animals of Ireland, right? You know, until he eventually is born again as a human. But one of the descriptions he gives is, and it's beautifully put, right, where he talks about how the salmon is the perfect form because he's utterly unencumbered. So when he describes being a stag, he has to tuck his legs under him, right, and he, you know, it's an awkward form, and goes on through to kind of the different kind of experiences of his life as a hawk, as his life as a boar, and then finally the salmon. And the salmon is this, like, you know, this beautiful creature, perfectly suited to its environment. It is, you know, there's totally unencumbered by limbs, just its fins cut through the water with perfection. And there's another story which you rightly assert is in the Finian cycle, which is about, it's called the Salmon of Knowledge. And every Irish school kid would have done this in primary school, right? And the story is essentially about how Fionn MacCool is the apprentice of a druid along the River Boyne, which is kind of in the Boyne Valley, which is the seat of the High Kings and the Royal Valley, where all the great megalithic tombs are, Newgrange, Doubs, now, what have you. He's apprenticing to him, and he's under a false name because he's hiding from the kind of his opposing clan, who also are part of the Fianna. And this druid is Finnegas is his name, and he has been staying by the Riverboyne trying to catch the Salmon of Knowledge. Right, the Salmon of Knowledge comes from this mythic pool, which is surrounded by 9 hazel trees. And as the hazelnuts drop into the sea, they contain the world's knowledge, and the salmon eats them and embodies that knowledge. So it is an embodiment of Gnosis. And this is where I think that as the salmon kind of go, the place is called Conal as well, right? Which is said to be the source of the Boyne. So it's this mythic well, this mythic kind of womb. And the salmon swims from this womb through the Atlantic into the River Boyne, where he is caught. And under instruction, Fionn cooks the fish, but is told under no circumstances taste or eat it. Anyway, there's a blister on the fish's skin, and he squishes it with his thumb and burns his thumb, and then puts his thumb in his mouth to soothe the pain. And as he does so, he absorbs the world knowledge. And as he goes out through the stories, he bites his thumb and he receives Gnosis. So the poet comes back and he eats the fish, and expecting this kind of this total Gnosis to happen, and it doesn't. And he realizes that actually Fionn is the one destined to get all this great Gnosis. But what struck me when I was writing the book is the symbol of the fish being this perfect living jewel, this unencumbered form that can navigate the waters of the other world into ours. And that the story is representative of the Vaisia Pisces, you know? And that's kind of what jumped out at me in that, you know, and that's what folklore, I think, helps us do. It helps us understand and map the otherscape, the landscape of the other world that intersects with ours, that intersects with our dreams, you know, that brings us Gnosis. And that's really why I was so drawn to the folklore, because it is such an efficient form for the Gnosis of the other world to come into ours, you know.
Very much, yeah. It's always there. It's always flowing. We just forgot to look at it, for sure. Yeah. And I mean,
I often think that that folklore is it's like our dream history.
Yes, very true. Yeah, and I mean, you're talking about daemons, and of course, some said the daemon is our higher self or a higher mind, but. Let's be honest, as Richard Smalley said, Hermes is always associated with the mind and the trickster, and the Greeks weren't stupid. This is no accident, because the greatest liar, the greatest devil, the greatest creator of false realities is our own mind, right, Dara? I mean, that's where we don't even need a dark man to throw us off a cliff, right?
We're perfectly capable of doing it ourselves, that's for sure.
We are, we're this sort of mechanical dark man who creates false realities, fools ourselves, and doesn't want to see. At the same time, like Hermes, we have the ability to use our knowledge to go beyond the stars. So it's a trickster too. And speaking of, how do you relate the dark man to the djinn? And I know part of this overlaps with the idea of these beings that come and help us, thing like you mentioned, fallen angels, the watchers, the titans with Prometheus, Anunnaki, these stories of these beings that help us. Could you put, would the djinn be in that, or what category it did? Because as you write, they're not happy with humans. Because God made them bow to us or something.
There's a huge and really interesting overlap between fairy lore and djinn lore. So in 2016 I went to Delhi to shoot a story essentially visiting the sites in Delhi and photographing them for that were referenced in the book by William Dalrymple, City of Djinns. So he's a Scottish historian and kind of a travel writer. And this was his, essentially his journal of his time in Delhi as a young correspondent. It's a wonderful book, and his books are fantastic. They're really, really great. I mean, most of the cool stuff that I kind of shot, well, I think it's cool, stuff that I shot in India was, you know, as a direct result of reading his books, you know. Fantastic author. So went off to shoot these different places. I won't labor the point, but like a bunch of stuff happened where I came back going, I'm deeply unnerved by what went on. But I started doing an awful lot of exploration into djinn lore and trying to understand it and unpack it more. And, you know, basically kind of, I went off kind of gung ho to shoot the story about the djinn. And about a bunch of nightmares that turned out to be in the places I was going to visit.
Oh boy.
Right. My equipment broke. I had like a load of hassle, and I'm very familiar with Delhi and India. I spent like the time before that, I spent 6 months knocking around. I know the city pretty well, right? But I had a like really rough landing. But anyway, came back, did a lot of research into the djinn. Probably one of the standout books is Robert Liebling's Legends of the Fire Spirits. If anybody's interested in djinn, that's, I'd say, one of the go-to texts. Fantastic anthology, really well researched. And out of that, I was unpacking a lot of it, and I was kind of, this reminded me of fairy lore, you know, and really specific stuff, you know, like the djinn travel in wind, fairies travel in the Shi Giha, the fairy wind. And stuff like changelings, same thing in Irish fairy lore. Down to specific like taboos, like things like throwing dirty water out of the house. You know, like there would be some kind of small prayer said in Cairo, for example, where you throw dirty water in the house and you say, Bismillah, you know, dirty water coming, no offense. You see the exact same thing in the west of Ireland in some rural village in Mayo, right? You know, in like Ballygo Nowhere with 10 people, right? They're doing the same thing. They're throwing their dirty water at the house, going like, Huggy Huggy, Ishka Salik, Ichacht, like, so. You know, look out, there's dirty water coming. So they wouldn't offend the fairies. So very, just remarkable similarities. So, I mean, my conclusion of the whole, that whole thing is we're talking about the same thing, but from a different cultural lenses, essentially, you know. And I also think, like, when I say the same thing, I think they are culturally specific. You know, it's the landscape, the culture, how they're perceived are going to be different. But in essence, it's probably a manifestation of something very similar. But when we get into the origin myths of the djinn, they are one of the sentient, sapient creations of Allah. So he created three types of beings, angels, he created from light, djinn, he created from smokeless fire, and humans, he created from sounding clay. Now, in the kind of the story of the schism in heaven, basically what happened is there was one djinn who'd been elevated to the host of angels for being particularly genius and highly capable, of the name of Iblis. In my early kind of videos, back in the kind of the late 2010s, I was notoriously pronouncing this incorrectly. Which got me a lot of my first stallions with shit comments on YouTube. so I now have learned how to pronounce it correctly. Right. But Iblis is often depicted as this jet black figure. And he was elevated to the host of angels. And then when the time came when Adam was created, Allah commanded the host to bow to Adam. And the angels, not in possession of free will, did as commanded, but Iblis refused. Saying, I am better than him. I am made of fire and he is made of sounding clay. This resulted in him being cast out. And he made this promise to beset Allah's creation from behind, from before, from left and right, to lead him away from his straight path, right? Which kind of leans into that kind of interceptor as well, like the broken journey. And this is where this kind of schism happens. Now, equally, in Irish fairy lore, you have the idea that the fairies are actually fallen angels. They're the ones who lost the battle in heaven. Okay. weren't evil enough to fall into hell. They just fell below the land and lived in the cairns and the circles and what have you. So again, very, very similar. Those things really jumped out at me and kind of going, well, but these are remarkably similar. Did this happen because of like just migration of ideas? So bearing in mind, Islam never got to Ireland. It was a Christian country from like the Patrick, I think it was in the fourth century or the third century, when he is said to arrive. So why do we have such kind of like specific similarities in these myths for these invisible beings? Equally, the jinn are associated with the inspiration for poetry, as we said before, and we have inspiration in music with fairies. Same thing, like clans, kingdoms, you know, very similar kind of hierarchical structures, you know. And I, you know, I think it's fair to say that this is kind of, you know, like you would have desert tribes describing a desert tribe structure because that's their understanding of how societies work. And equally, you would have the equivalent in these Celtic countries doing the same. So yeah, there's huge overlaps. And it's quite interesting. There's another interesting bit though as well with the Tua are said to come from the north, right? Come from the Northlands, the Great Northlands, where they learnt their skills in the occult and witchcraft and all the various different sciences that they brought to Ireland, the science of agriculture, of medicine and what have you. They learnt these in these four cities in the northern regions. And the Mercator map, the early kind of Mercator map depicts, and I'm sure your readers or your listeners are familiar with this, four islands with the lodestone mountain, Rubus Nigre, you know, this magnetic mountain, which is believed by the magnets point north because the giant magnet mountain is in the north. So the Tua had four cities from which they brought the great treasures of the Tua, the Danann, to Ireland, and where they learned all their great occult sciences. There's a fascinating piece in the Apocrypha, the Book of Adam and Eve, where Satan talks about living in a garden of the north and trying to entice Adam to come to the garden of the north, where his family were. You know, and so it's fun to hypothesize, well, who were the family, you know, the Tua maybe, you know. So it's pure conjecture, obviously, but it's a fun area to explore. But there's another layer to it as well, which relates to the jinn lore. So that mountain is known in Islamic lore or Arabic lore rather as Mount Qaf, right? So I know I'm not pronouncing that correctly, but it's also an Arabic letter. But it refers to the slopes of Mount Qaf are said to be the home of the cities of the jinn, emerald cities of the jinn. Beautiful light illuminates the skies around it, the northern lights. So we have these kind of multiple layers that tie in fallen angels, the jinn, the Tua, all to these mythical Hyperborean lands in the North Pole.
Wow. Yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah, it's like with the rabbi, it reminds me of the story when the son asked the rabbi about the flood story, and it said, did this ever happen? And the rabbi's, well, I don't know if it ever happened, but I know it's true. It's a little subtle, you know, what they say about myth, it never was, but always is. It's almost like it's the story behind the story, the eternal story. And what's too important, Dara, is also the other component of the dark man that you probably mentioned is that they are the guardians to the womb of death, right? And again, we go back to Hermes, the psychopomps. They're the ones that can take us not just to the other world, but to the underworld and what's behind them, the eternity, life, death.
Yeah, absolutely. The theme of this dark womb and the cave that it sits in is a really potent one. And there's one there's one aspect in the book, and I should explain that the book is part made up of interviews of people who've had various different experiences, but the cave of the dark womb or the dark womb seems to be kind of this liminal place that some people go to when they have a very, very potent dark man experience. It's not usually not the first one. It'll be kind of several ones on, but it is this kind of like void waters. That is this kind of like cold furnace of creation that people go to envision. Is a proper chthonic. It's almost like a chthonic baptism. This immersion in these primordial waters, and again, it kind of ties a little bit to this Connell as well thing. This other world well, from where the knowledge comes from, where the gnosis came from, in the fish's perfect form, the salmon's perfect form. But the theme of cave is innately tied to this. And one of the things that I noted when I wrote the section on kind of the we call it kind of the rewilding of the soul, that is, there's a cave in Arige, France, called Trois Frères, and on the wall of this cave, it's said to be like approximately 13,000 BC, there's a composite being, a Therianthrope, known as the Sorcerer, and it was discovered by a guy called Henry Brule. He published drawings of this in like the 1920s, and it's like it has a set of horns, an owl's face, a beard, a part human torso, animal legs. It's a composite being. And there's another one in Dardoyne, which is also called the Sorcerer. Now, and it's the same thing, antlered head, so you've got the deer themes, and you've got the composite. I play on this idea that these caves were our first temples. You know, and you know, absolutely, I'm not the first person to notice this. I mean, Peter Gray talks about the exact same cave art in Apocalyptic Witchcraft. Robert Anderson talks about it in some of his work. The difference is I wasn't aware of it. I only found it after the fact, after I'd kind of stumbled on it, you know, which again is another kind of like dark man laughing at you, you know, is teaching humility. It's like, you thought you were hot shit figuring this out? You're not.
No.
Yeah, you know. But this cave, right, it lends itself to the idea of like the cave was our first temple. Now, these are awful places to get into, let alone go in and paint, let alone go in and carve and scratch which is into the walls. They're extraordinarily difficult. You know, with no electronic light, how the hell did you do that? Extremely difficult. You know, it warranted a lot of effort, which, you know, belies a real drive to do this, you know, for real motivation to do it. And what I hypothesize is that we replicated those tombs. Our ancestors replicated those caves in the cairns that they built, right? And the most notable ones in Ireland are Nowth, Dowth, and Newgrange. Newgrange being probably the most famous. There's another one called Four Knocks, which is, I'm hoping to go to this Sunday, actually. But what I propose is that if we look at these cairns on the shortest day of the year, in the winter solstice, the dawn, rising sun illuminates the chambers within Newgrange. As the dawn breaks, the beam of sunlight comes through this, it's a box just above the door, and illuminates the back end chambers. Now at sunset, Dowth, Dowth gets the same thing, right? So it is like this solar phallus is impregnating the vulva of the earth down into that dark womb.
Wow.
Let life begin again. Now, interestingly, in mythology, and I only found this out after I finished the book, that Newgrange was said to be the home of the Dagada, right? And the Dagada is another one of these figures who seems the dark magician of the men of God, I would say is referring to Dagada, right? Who's one of the Tuatha. All right, and he's associated with Newgrange, although his son tricked him out of it in some sort of, you know, one of these god arguments. but what's super interesting about this is that if we think about this as the solar phallus entering the vulva of the earth to impregnate the womb, right? And this is this expression that has come to so many people who have had this experience, that this is the dark womb, right? That you're in this void, this chthonic, like primordial birth waters from where all creation comes. It's extraordinary when you think of it, because the cave of vulva, as I said, hints to a womb within. Right. But it is tying again to this idea of Connell as well, where the knowledge comes from. But when we start to look at it in terms of how Christianity changed the view of things, we find the vulva, right, the entrance into the goddess as a living landscape, right? Instead of being the source of creation and the source of wonder, becomes the hellmouth, the entry into the underworld, the entry into the hell world.
Mm-hmm.
Totally flips it on its head. Right. And interestingly, coming back to the Pied Piper, the caves in the mountains, or the mountain cave that they're said to disappear in, the wall of the cave opens and they all disappear into the underworld. That actual mountaintop is called Calgary. It's renamed Calgary after the place where Christ died. So it's the same thing. This landscape was associated with pagan rites, and then is renamed Calgary to demonize it, essentially. So that's kind of what I talk to in the book around the symbolism of the cave as a womb, the cave containing the womb, right? But it talks about all this demonization, which I think is the same thing that's happened to why we get the Christian devil, right? But actually what we're talking about is the dark daemon of the world.
Yeah, God's prosecutor. You know, what he was in ancient times, whether it was Pazuzu or Azazel.
Exactly, exactly.
He's part of the natural cosmic order. You want to bitch about it, bitch all you want, right?
Yeah, totally. You know, and all the experience, like all the experiences that people have talked about, you know, the terror, or, you know, like the awful behavior that he exhibited to some of the witches in the Scottish witch trials. It's that's nature. You know, it's tooth and claw. It's blood and guts. You know, as much as it's joyful and celebratory, it is equally the reverse.
Yeah, you're right. Again, Dr. Evil, if I want to go out into the woods, there's a chance I'll see beauty, but there's a chance I'll get attacked by a coyote here or get some sort of tick and I'll get really sick.
Exactly, yeah.
So what advice, as we get to the end there, would you give to somebody who meets the dark man or works with the dark? We've talked about humility. I think the other one is be prepared to let go of everything you believed in, your beliefs, everything. Yeah. Just get ready to just have them crushed and just let go. You will come into it. Yeah, you will come into something new, but it will be better.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry, I'm being pestered by a large mosquito here.
Speaking of nature,
exactly. Yeah. Teaching me humility. I think, you know, one of the things that I'm quite keen to say is, I'm not a teacher in this. You know, I noticed a pattern, and then what came to me. But if people who I think want to learn about this, I would say people like Gemma Gary, Robin Artisan, from a witchcraft perspective, would do well to explore their work from an experiential point of view. It's going to hurt, you know, it's a kicking, but you do get to a far better place. You really do. And like the benefits of one's doing some shadow work is good, but it's not easy. It's really tough. And as we chatted about at the top of the show, like, you know, humility is the key word here. You know, you don't come out of it thinking I'm special. I'm the chosen one. That's the reverse happens. and I think that's just part of the journey. And I would say it's just an ongoing thing. Yeah,
for sure. And again, Dara has all these great interviews with practitioners. We talked about Megan Rose and others. So they have advice on their experiences and they all survive and they're better people today, better magicians, better occultists, better mystics. So before we let go, Graham, do you have any last question or comment, or what say you?
No, I very much enjoyed it. I appreciated tying in the Tua with the Hyperborea. I do have to, another guilty question of mine is one of my favorite obscure Celtic gods is Ogmios, the basically old man Hercules who became a bard. Any insights into him, Tag?
Interesting. Well, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned that because like the Daggeta seems to be have some overlap with Hercules, right? So like that, you often get the depiction of Hercules with the lion's robe but with a great club. So the Daggeta was said to have kind of a great club, and like with the top of it he could take away life, with the bottom of it he could restore life, and he was like a giant in some descriptions. But there's a fantastic chalk figure in, it's either Wiltshire or Dorset, called the Rude Man of Cern. I think it's Dorset. Which is this kind of large figure carved into the side of a chalk hill with a massive club and kind of an equally massive set of male genitalia, on which women used to go out and sleep on it overnight if they wanted to conceive. Right. So there's conjecture as to whether or not this is Hercules or is it the Daggeta, right? So there seems to be kind of an overlap there of some description, but the Daggeta was that kind of massive figure capable of incredible feats. I mean, one of the reasons he's called the Black Magician of the Men of God that relates to him is that in the Second Battle of Moytura, when the two are going up against the Fomorians, these sea demons, these kind of like chaotic, evil, destructive forces. They gather all their druids, the best druids in the Tua, to attack, magically attack the Fomorians. And Daggeta makes this declaration that I'm better than all of them. My magic is better. Right. So he's kind of like puts himself forward as that. I'm the best magician. So I don't know if that answers your question, but there's kind of overlap there.
No, you definitely covered a lot of it. Thank you.
No worries.
Wonderful. Well, yes, this has been a great conversation. And yeah, I didn't even, again, maybe when the Elvis books comes out, I forgot to mention I did go to Clarksdale, Mississippi to see Robert Johnson after I went to Graceland. And I did meet the Dark Man. So that's a story I want to share with you. And I have witnesses. I was with Steven Snyder and Dr. Sean Radin. So we did meet this weird black figure in the right at the crossroads that came out of nowhere. Yeah, we didn't think about it until later when we said, this person is from another historical time. And what he talked to us made no sense. Yeah. Even though we're asking him questions about what Robbie's, he was saying strange. But anyway, for another time too. Wow. But I would highly recommend Song of the Dark Man. And I have it on the show notes, but you want to send people to any websites, Dara?
I am. If they kind of want to know more about me, Dara Mason. .com. That's got all my photographic work, the stuff I was talking about, and kind of links off to kind of other bits and bobs that I've done. I have a podcast called Spirit Box. So if you haven't been bored to tears, listen to me here. You can find out, listen to me bleat on about a load of other stuff. You can do it there.
Wonderful. Yeah, check it out. Again, I will have it on the show notes. First, I'd say, Graham, thanks for keeping us company and keeping the chat room company. Good comments I saw from everybody.
Oh, always lots of fun and great comments in the chat.
Indeed, yes. And yes, thank you for those of you who came live. We will have the recording after this. Audio recording will come the next day, probably tomorrow. Yes, please subscribe, support Aeon Byte, support Dara, support all the alternative people. We're trying to keep this reality together and get us through the other side. As I say, as I tell people, Dara, and this is something that Jungians have said, this is really the age of Hermes, the age of the trickster. This is where the understanding of the Dark Man will help us. I know I argue with Thelemites. They're like, Aeon of Horus. And I'm like, we are nowhere near the AM before. I'm sorry. This is not, we're farther away than we were in the times of Crowley from the AM. I think Hermes is ruling this world, this age. So let's stick to that one. But yeah, Dara, thank you very much for coming on the show and good luck with your book and all your projects.
Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Pleasure's all ours. And for everybody, thanks for being here. Yeah, and thanks for being yourself, your true self. And I hope you find the dark man, Artemis, or that person that will take you to your true self. Take care, everybody. Oh, look who came. And a trickster just showed up as soon as I'm done. Take care, everybody.